Dear Kristen and Jolenta, women are brought up to apologize all the time for everything. We're supposed to apologize when someone bumps into us. We're supposed to apologize when someone misinterprets what we say. We're supposed to apologize from the day we're born until the day we die. Shouldn't you be telling your female audience to apologize less? NS. Dear NS, we're sorry. Ha! Just kidding. We're not sorry. But we do understand where you're coming from. And we absolutely agree with you to a point. Yes, women are told to apologize all the time, including moments when we've done nothing wrong. And we understand that many of our Canadian followers of all genders suffer from this same social programming. But to be clear, we're not asking you to apologize more. We're actually not asking you to do anything. We just want to illustrate how apologizing in a more targeted way, focused on understanding, remorse, restitution, and a deeper sense of human connection, made us feel better. It also made those we wronged feel better. That being said, we do wish certain people would practice more effective apologizing. Specifically, we're referring to politicians, captains of industry, and people in power more broadly, many of whom refuse to admit when they've done something wrong, much less try to make things right. So, NS, if you happen to be one of these people in power, I'm going to backtrack and say, yes, we actually do want you to apologize more and apologize more effectively. Doing so will make you a more decent human being and more popular with the masses regardless of your gender. And isn't that what you want? Of course it is. Kristen. Get off your device. I am not what you would call a digital native. I did not grow up with a cell phone or internet. We didn't have a home computer or even a TV with a remote control. The most sophisticated piece of entertainment technology we had in my house when I was growing up was a dual cassette deck and record-playing stereo, which I bought in junior high school after saving up months of babysitting money. This lack of technology is partly because I'm a few years past being a millennial. It's also because my parents had absolutely no interest in gadgets. They didn't see the point of them. When I wanted to use a computer, I went to my Auntie Lane's house. She had an ancient Apple II. I inherited my parents' lack of interest in technology. When a new gizmo comes out, I usually don't care. Alternatively, I might find myself a bit suspicious and asking a lot of questions. What if this product is just a flash in the pan? I'm talking to you, Palm Pilot. Or what if there are loads of kinks to work out? Yes, you, first-generation Apple Mouse. And why is this new piece of metal so freaking expensive? Once I finally decide to purchase a gadget, you'd better believe I use it until it's dead. I will replace the batteries and parts. I will do anything I can to keep my machine going. I don't care if it's out of fashion. You know what I do care about? Depleting the world of more natural resources for the sake of a new gizmo, and throwing yet another device into the landfill, and wasting money. No thanks. That's why I was the last person in America to buy a cellular flip phone, and why I continued to use that flip phone until 4 years ago, when it inevitably stopped working and the Verizon store stopped carrying them, and I was forced to buy a smartphone with a touchscreen like the rest of civilization. And so, I was a bit surprised when Jolenta and I tracked our screen time for Manoush Zomorodi's Bored and Brilliant to find that I stared at my smartphone almost as much as she stares at hers. Jolenta, by her own admission, loves her phone. She's referred to it as her life, her best friend, her everything. She began using a cell phone in high school. Her father liked technology and kept it in the house. And during our time living by Bored and Brilliant, she discovered that she looks at her phone for over 2 hours a day. When I got real about my technology usage, I also realized my phone was my life, despite my claims of being a Luddite. Turns out, the last thing I do before going to bed each night is look at my phone. The first thing I do each morning is look at my phone. Several evenings a week, I scroll through eBay while watching TV with my husband as he sits beside me playing video games. I go onto the Buy the Book Facebook community and Twitter pages at least once an hour to check on the conversations there. What's worse, I lie to myself about why I keep looking. I'll tell myself it's to moderate comment threads or to let new people in, but the fact is, I'm addicted. Of course, I'd convinced myself I wasn't addicted for years, and not just because I grew up in a tech-averse house. I was proud of the fact that I didn't play video games and that I never texted while behind the wheel, even at a stoplight. I smugly watched people texting at restaurants and ignoring their families and thought, I'll never be like that. I told myself I wasn't chained to my phone. But if I was looking at my phone for 2 hours a day, maybe I was. Now, it's important to note that Bored and Brilliant wasn't just about tracking our phone usage. And to be clear, it wasn't really even about cutting down on how often we use our phones. Spoiler, at the end of 2 weeks, Jolenta and I found that we'd cut down on our use by only a few minutes. It was about freeing our brains to be, as the title suggests, a little more bored and a little more creative. Because when our brains are constantly being entertained, they aren't necessarily busying themselves making new ideas. The book's exercises included commuting without our devices, deleting addictive apps, going full days without taking photos, and just sitting in public places while staring out at the world, all in the name of letting our minds wander. For the grand finale of the book, we were instructed to identify an aspect of our lives that we were confused by, avoiding, or downright terrified to think about. It could be large or small. Then we had to sit down for 30 minutes, completely free from distractions, though we were allowed to watch a pot of water boil, which I did. When the 30 minutes were up, we were to list or draw or write out a solution to the problem we'd started with. For me, it worked. My conundrum was finding a way to stay in touch with my friends and family in a manner that didn't feel overwhelming and that I wouldn't give up on after 2 days. Sending out mass emails seemed impersonal and like too much work. Facebook came with too many distractions. With the exception of 3 or 4 friends, nobody I knew ever wanted to talk on the phone anymore. I stared at my pot of water and let my mind wander. And then, after 30 minutes, I sat down and wrote. What I came up with was, quote, a single sentence. To be clear, I decided that I'd text a single line to a different friend every week. All it had to be was a line like, remember our imaginary dog in college? It could turn into a longer thread, but it didn't have to. The only goal was to spend a moment thinking of a friend and to let that friend know. It's now been years, but I still try to text a single sentence to someone at least once a week. And yes, I see the irony in the fact that my Bored and Brilliant breakthrough involved a screen. Jolenta also found her mind drawn to creative places when she put down her device. Without the distraction of her screen, her thoughts gravitated toward old creative outlets, like the piano, which she started playing again with some success. In the absence of Instagram feeds of dogs, she looked at real-life dogs and asked questions about how they navigated the world. And when it came time for her to attend the wedding of a dear friend, she didn't even feel tempted to take out her phone to take a photo during the ceremony. Instead, she chose to completely live in that magic moment. The experience made her happier. Now, Bored and Brilliant isn't the only book we've lived by that suggests cutting down on technology usage. Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Workweek, which was filled with both good and bad advice, suggests setting aside only a few times a day to do things like check email. The rest of the time, Ferriss suggests leaving an out-of-office-style message explaining that there may be delays in response time. Ferriss's reasoning is that choosing only certain times to be online will cut down on how much dilly-dallying and distraction we fall into so we can spend more of our lives doing the things we really want to, like learning a foreign language, starting a business, or mastering the art of horseback archery, as he did. And Jolenta and I certainly found we had more time, though I admit that I did cheat on this one a bit because, hey, I love to work. Of course, not every book we've lived by suggests putting down our phones. One in particular, called Pants Drunk, encouraged us to pour ourselves a glass of wine, take off our pants, lounge on the sofa, and scroll through social media as a way of recharging. Pants Drunk author Mishka Rantanen didn't see phones as demons at all, though he did advise against going on certain websites or answering work email. Jolenta, an introvert, found Pants Drunk's advice restorative. She loved having permission not to be productive and to feed her brain candy. I, on the other hand, found it sad-making. As an extrovert, sitting alone and drinking while reading sometimes unkind social media comments from listeners made me miserable. While Pants Drunk didn't set out to make me put down my phone, I learned from living by it that I'm far happier drinking if I ignore my phone and spend time with friends. One last thing worth mentioning here. none of the books we've lived by have told us to go cold turkey on our device usage. They haven't tried to kill our addictions. Rather, they've attempted to train us to use our devices more strategically and with more thought. The books all seem to accept that devices are a part of modern life and are impossible to sever ourselves from completely. I tend to agree, though I do sometimes miss the days when most of the world was phone-free. I liked sitting at a dinner table where people weren't constantly checking their social media. I liked not worrying about other drivers texting or playing video games on the road. I miss the days of sitting in movie theaters, where the worst transgression of those around me was whispering or making out, not Candy Crush and Snapchat. I suppose this is just my way of saying that not only am I happier when I spend less time on my devices, but I'm happier when the people around me spend less time on their devices as well. Unless, of course, I'm texting a single sentence to a friend, or looking at eBay while sitting on the couch next to my husband with the TV on. Live below your means. When I was quite young, still in grade school, my parents got divorced. My father landed quite comfortably in the home of his soon-to-be second wife. Meanwhile, my mother went from working one retail job to three. The only way we survived was with my nana's free childcare, groceries, housekeeping, and cooking, as well as the leftover food my mom brought home from one of her jobs. In time, with my mother's second marriage, money became slightly less tight, but I was still expected to have a job and pay for everything from my maxi pads to my school pictures out of my own pocket. When I went off to college, I, like my mother before me, began working three jobs in order to pay the tuition bills and rent. I brought home food from the restaurants that I worked at that was destined for the trash. I squeezed my classes between my shifts. On more than one occasion, I bounced a check. All that money stress took its toll. Well into my 30s, I carried a fear of homelessness inside me, and not just homelessness, but a whole imaginary scenario that involved two babies, a cardboard box, and drinking turpentine straight from the can. Part of what helped me deal with the fear was living below my means, and I learned from the best. My nana, who grew up during the Great Depression and was orphaned at a young age, was the queen of living well on less. She shopped garage sales, used the same tea bag all day, and kept every container of every prepared food she'd ever bought to use as, quote, free Tupperware. She didn't have a lot of knickknacks, and she didn't buy anything for full price. If you complimented her on her dress or sweater, she'd invariably respond by saying how much she'd saved on that dress or sweater, a habit that I also have. The other thing that helped me tackle my turpentine fears was, quite frankly, making more money. From the ages of 17 to 25, I never earned more than $22,000 per year at my salaried day jobs, which is why I always waited tables and worked other jobs on the side. In my 30s, I started to earn more, but I continued to live as though my salary was still $22,000, putting a large percentage of my paychecks in retirement and savings accounts. Now, I know we live in a world where living on less is considered the opposite of sexy. Shopping is one of our greatest pastimes. Owning stuff indicates success. McMansions, gadgets, and trendy fashions are supposedly central to our happiness. Choosing to live below our means really means saying no to a lot of the messages we're fed from the time we're babies. But more and more influential self-help authors are suggesting we do it. The first book to really send this message to Jolenta and me was America's Cheapest Family Gets You Right on the Money by Steve and Annette Economides. Over the first 12 years of their marriage, the Economides family lived on an average income of $35,000. During that time, they paid off their first home, bought a second home twice the size of the first, and bought several cars for cash. They did all this through dozens of tricks, which included purchasing only secondhand items, not owning credit cards, and grocery shopping only once per month in order to cut down on gas money and impulse buying. I mostly loved living by the Economides method. It made saving money feel like a game and shopping feel like a frivolous waste of time and money. And while Jolenta didn't love the book quite as much as I did, it helped her to face her anxieties about money for the first time in her adult life, which led to tough but important conversations with her husband and even learning to log onto her bank account for the first time. But for the most part, America's Cheapest Family presents only the most basic financial reasons for living below our means, so that we can have a home, a car, and a retirement fund. Other books present more exciting and/or emotional reasons. For example, The 9 Steps to Financial Freedom by Susie Orman suggests that living below our means can help us to feel emotionally in control of our money rather than the other way around. In the 4-Hour Workweek, Tim Ferriss suggests that we can all lead more interesting lives if we spend less money on material items and more on low-cost experiences, some of which may even earn us money. One way of doing this is by temporarily living in a less expensive country than our own and working remotely while renting out our home for profit. Although neither Jolenta nor I did this while living by Ferriss's book, my husband and I have since rented out our home when we've traveled, which has helped pay for our trips. In The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, Marie Kondo presents another reason for living below our means. Because owning lots of things also means the potential for lots of clutter. Clutter is a source of frustration for many of us, especially when it is made up of things that we don't need or love. Why not just hold on to the things that spark joy and bring fewer items into our homes after that? And then, of course, there's Bea Johnson's environmental argument for living below our means. In Zero Waste Home, she tells the story of how she and her family once lived the suburban American dream with a big lawn, a 3-car garage, a giant house, and lots of objects to fill that giant house. Her family consumed gallons of bottled water every week, thoughtlessly purchased single-use plastics, and reassured themselves that, because they recycled, they weren't really damaging the planet. In her early 30s, Johnson started to see her family's wasteful habits for what they were: destructive to the planet. After that, she and her family made a decision. They would be better stewards of the earth, and they would begin at home. They started walking rather than driving whenever possible, moved to a much smaller home, and shopped only for what they needed while avoiding anything packaged. Among the main pieces of information that Jolenta and I took to heart while living by her book was that refusing to purchase or accept things, even free things, was the most powerful thing we could do on a daily basis for the planet. We could say no to straws with drinks. We could refuse bags at grocery stores. We could say no to turning up the heat or turning on the air conditioner. We could say no to taxis and fast fashion and new gadgets and long showers. And we could refuse to buy anything in a package, even if the package claimed to be recyclable, because the vast majority of recycling programs in the United States do very little recycling and use a tremendous amount of resources in the process. We could live with less. We could live below our means, and in the process, regardless of a book's primary motivation in telling us to do so, we found one common side effect. We were able to live more in the moment. When we focus less on things, we could focus more on people and experiences. When we learned to stop chasing more stuff, we could learn to be grateful for the stuff we already had. And when we pared down what we owned, we could better understand what we didn't need, what we did, and what truly made our lives better. Dear Kristen and Jolenta, it's great to live below your means, but what if you hardly have enough means to live on in the first place? SH. Dear SH, you bring up such a valid point. The fact is, 12.3% of Americans live below the poverty line, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and millions more people around the world barely scrape by. Living on less is absolutely not realistic for everyone. But my point in this chapter was not to suggest that everyone follow in my footsteps. Rather, it was to illustrate how budgeting, even during my poorest years, has kept my money anxieties from completely taking over my life, and in some cases, has even made me happier. Kristen.
Declutter. When the decluttering book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, first came out and became a global hit, I scoffed at it. How could something so simple as the idea of putting your stuff away be that life-changing? Part of my resistance was just a reaction to the sheer popularity of the book. I pride myself on liking quirky, unique objects, not the same dumb stuff everyone else likes. But not unlike my experience with a popular book series about a young man going to wizarding school, when I finally read what lay in those popular pages, I was sold. Turns out some stuff is popular for a reason. Marie Kondo is a Japanese organizational consultant whose method of decluttering is known as KonMari, a combination of her last and first names. The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up has sold millions of copies globally. According to Marie Kondo, The long game goal of tidying isn't simply having less clutter. It's also about making us happier and living only with the items that truly spark joy in our lives. And in order to appreciate the things that are important to us, we have to toss out the things that have outlived their purpose. This may sound simple, but trust me, it's not. It's a ton of work. Kondo says to effectively figure out which of your belongings spark joy within your soul, you need to take one or two whole days to do a deep clean to get rid of any belongings you have that may be holding you back or are unnecessary. And to make things even more complicated, you can't just go from room to room seeing what you want to get rid of. Kondo says to go by category of belongings, because categories can be spread across various rooms. Kondo says the best sequence for starting your decluttering cleaning journey is this: clothes first, then books, papers, miscellaneous household items, and last, mementos. So when we live by this book back in season one of By the Book, I did just that. I started by dumping every article of clothing I had into a pile on the bedroom floor and picked up each individual garment from my wedding dress to my gym socks. This took an entire day. It was exhausting. I loathed it. Cleaning my clutter was going to be the death of me. I started hating every item of clothing I picked up after a few hours and had to keep going on walks around the block to clear my head and cool down so I didn't end up throwing out every article of clothing I owned. But after slogging through the first day, going through other belongings became not only easier but also more satisfying. Halfway through day two of my deep clean, I had a breakthrough. When Brad and I got to the miscellaneous electronics category, we gathered up every electronic device, charger, USB drive, plug adapter, and pair of headphones we could find and spread them all out on the bed. And to our dismay, we saw we had a shocking number of obsolete electronics and accompanying accessories. The charger for a digital camera I no longer own, a binder full of hundreds of CDs Brad burned during his first year of college, and probably 100 random odds and ends that we didn't even know we owned. It was gross seeing so much of this useless garbage all in one place. Most of that junk had been with each of us since before we started dating years ago. Some of it had even moved with us across the country from our childhood homes in Oregon and California, dragged from apartment to apartment for over a decade. After seeing how much unnecessary stuff we had cluttering up our little lives, we started understanding why we were doing what we were doing. After that moment, tidying up literally began to feel kind of magical. Seriously, as corny as it sounds, I started liking it more and more. Downsizing everything we owned felt freeing. Finding a place for everything we kept was like putting together a sexy-ass puzzle made out of all the things I love. I hated the decluttering process at first and grew to love it. To this day, Brad and I say The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up is the one book I've lived by that made life better for both of us. We love the results of downsizing our possessions and unloading all the old belongings we'd been carrying around with us like dead weight. We can't get enough of bare counters and efficient storage hacks. We love how clean, bright, and calm our decluttered home has become. Kristen's experience was pretty much the opposite. She started with optimism and attacked her deep clean with the kind of Midwestern gusto only Kristen has. She felt accomplished as she made piles of clothes to donate and got rid of old home workout tapes. But as time went on, the more she and her husband Dean went through their stuff, the more tension grew. Kristen and Dean rarely fight. They get along so well, you'd think they're a happy-go-lucky couple from a made-for-TV movie. Before the new nanny they hire tries to take over Kristen's life, that is. But the way Marie Kondo told them to arrange their home put them on edge, made them tense, and made their lives super inconvenient. Things they needed by the sink or in the shower were not next to the sink or in the shower. They were hidden away in boxes and cupboards. Tools they needed by the stove weren't next to the stove. They were in drawers beyond reach. It was maddening for them both, and in order to cut down on their bickering and get back to their happy made-for-TV norm, they slowly scaled back their extreme minimalism and let some choice clutter reappear throughout their home. As they found their decluttering balance, Kristen began to notice that all of her and Dean's belongings were much more integrated than they had been before. You see, Kristen moved into Dean's apartment when they started living together, so everything she brought with her was crammed wherever it would fit. It wasn't until they took the time to get rid of excess and reorganize what they owned that she realized she could feel even more at home where she was living. Overall, finding time to take stock of what I own and what I actually want has improved my life every time the idea has popped up in a self-help book we've lived by. When we lived by Anushka Reese's The Curated Closet a few seasons later, Kristen and I loved purging our wardrobes and defining our styles. While we lived by Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, I decided to amp up my creativity by giving my office a makeover. I sorted, got rid of needless papers and other random things that didn't need to be there, and reorganized the furniture. After clearing out the clutter and implementing new systems of order, my office went from a disorganized room where we threw our coats to the place that I work in and enjoy all the time. I'm even sitting and writing this story in the damn room right now. Through various forms of decluttering, including a huge deep clean and smaller scale closet and office tidying sessions, what I've really noticed is this. The space around me is an extension of me. And just like me, these extensions of my existence deserve love, respect, and care. Decluttering helps me reconnect to myself, check in with who I currently am, and get rid of any old baggage that might be holding me back. But Kristen and I learned the hard way that extreme decluttering is definitely not for everyone. It was even a difficult process for me, and I ended up loving it. So don't worry about going balls deep if you want to begin getting rid of clutter in your life that's no longer serving you. You can start with an office, a closet, a junk drawer. But not unlike that Wizarding book series I mentioned at the top of this story, it's definitely worth a try. Dear Kristen Angelenta, it seems that only a person who's well-to-do can really celebrate downsizing. People who genuinely live hand-to-mouth have so little already. SJ. Dear SJ, you make a super good point, and I wish we had touched on this idea more when we lived by this book for the podcast. A lot of the literature out there on decluttering and wellness in general seems to be written for people with the luxury of the means and time to hold each of their belongings to see what sparks joy. And that doesn't even include the money that comes with inevitably having to rebuy something you accidentally decluttered but still need, despite its inability to light your heart afire with passion. But what has really continued to make my life more enjoyable since initially decluttering are the organizational systems that are part of the process. You don't necessarily have to throw things out to feel that the space around you functions more smoothly and sparks more joy. I enjoyed experimenting with Kondo's advice on how to store and categorize the paperwork and letters I had around my apartment. That cost nothing. And now I always know where to find my blank checks or the dog's vaccination records. My husband, Brad, years later, still folds his clothes in the little spirals like the book recommends. He didn't get rid of many clothes, but he loves how happy looking into his closet makes him and how easy it is to see every garment and pick what to wear every morning. So you can still totally play around with aspects of minimalism and decluttering without having to sacrifice any of your belongings. And you only try it if that's something you want to do. Decluttering is totally not necessary to live a happy life, but for some of us, it can help. Jolenta. Try new things. With my aforementioned aversion to adventure, trekking, and all things wanderlust, you'd think I hate trying new things. And until recently, I would have agreed with you. I too thought I hated trying new things until we lived by a book called Year of Yes. Year of Yes follows TV writer and producer Shonda Rhimes' year-long journey to say yes to everything that came her way after her sister told her she said no to everything. The book digs into some of the reasons and excuses that Shonda gave for so long for saying no, from social anxiety to fear of embarrassment to simply being an introvert. And it shows how saying yes can help make life more enjoyable in the long run and is in fact a necessary part of growing, learning, and becoming a better person. Living by Year of Yes was a pure joy for Kristen and me. We each said yes in our own ways, and it enhanced both of our lives. I said yes to coffee with a new friend. hosting a party, hosting a women's networking event, and getting a foot rub. I even said yes to dressing my dog up as a squirrel and taking him to a costume parade. Kristen said yes to spending time with loved ones when she made the effort to see a friend who was in town from London. They caught up on each other's lives, spotted a Real Housewife of New York out on the town, hint for you Housewife fans, turtle time. And since her friend is a freelance podcast host and she had just transitioned to freelancing, he ended up giving her some great advice on next steps. His input led to Kristen saying yes to starting a freelancer club, so she didn't lose her mind with boredom while learning to work in a less social environment. One of the coolest things about living by Year of Yes has come in the form of the slow realization that I'm actually kind of good at saying yes to new things. Duh, I literally co-host a podcast where I try new things every 2 weeks. In fact, saying yes to something new is how basically everything I love has come into my life. Saying yes to taking one storytelling class is how I eventually found my way into doing stand-up comedy. Saying yes to hanging out with a goofy acquaintance is how I ended up married to Brad. I bet if you look back at your life, you'll see there are lots of badass, brave yeses you've said to new things that took you places you never imagined you'd go. That's very cool, if you ask me. You can even say yes when things feel out of control. Kristen is the perfect example of this. Right before we started living by Year of Yes, Kristen was informed that the podcasting company that employed her full-time was shutting down and she was about to be unemployed. This time was hell for her, but saying yes to new things here and there helped her make the most out of a less-than-ideal situation. She said yes to asking for help and sent emails to freelancer friends in the industry whom she admires, asking if she could meet up with them and get advice. She found a community for herself and created a freelancer co-working club with a few friends. Kristen also worked on her brand. She plugged her website like a beast and submitted herself for speaking engagements and podcast guest spots. She threw herself into saying yes to every new thing that she could think of or that came her way. And in doing so, she turned getting fired into embarking on her kick-ass solo career. Within months of being fired and all the new things that came with that, Kristen was hosting a podcast at a new company, guest hosting others, and even writing her own book, So You Want to Start a Podcast. So she had a lot to say yes to. Since we read Year of Yes, I've started being able to see my life as a series of brave choices to try new things. And if trying new things usually leaves me feeling like I've got a list of badass accomplishments in my wake, then I guess I'm pretty into trying new things. As long as those new things aren't trekking. I still say no to that. Sorry, Brad. Recharge. My alone time is sacred. When I say alone time, I am not talking about masturbation. Okay, sometimes I am talking about masturbation. I mean time spent on my own doing something relaxing, indulgent, or even mind-numbing. I always credit my love of quiet solitude to the fact that I'm an only child. I've been chilling on my own since day one. But until recently, this wasn't cool. For the majority of my life, I felt that my need for a little me time to replenish my energy was a weakness. Our society tends to idealize extroversion. We often equate successful people with outgoing, super social personalities. I was under the impression that people like me, who need to remove themselves from the world and rest in order to thrive, would never be as successful as those who don't have this weakness. Fortunately, I was wrong about this. In the past few years, there has been an introvert revolution. The self-help shelves are flooded with books about how to essentially stay in, eat, drink, light a candle, and relax your way to happiness. When we lived by a book called Pants Drunk, which promoted this kind of introverted recharging, I was as happy as a pig in poo. The Finnish concept of kulttuurikani, Pants Drunk, centers on relaxing at home in your undies while drinking and with no intention of leaving the house. Indulging in a pants-drunk evening is supposed to help recenter you after long, stressful days and give you a chance to partake in the ease of meaningful meaninglessness. I was overjoyed to see this advice in a book. Finally, a way I already take care of myself is validated as something other people think is worth trying and even writing a book about. Within seconds of finishing the book, I had cracked open a bottle of rosé apple cider, turned on a Lifetime movie about a cyber stalker, and got my recharge on. By the end of our 2 weeks living by Pants Drunk, I was a master of all things revitalizing and indulgent. I experimented with eating bags of chocolate chips while watching Real Housewives marathons and texting funny GIFs to my best friend while I sipped a beer and did a face mask. I was staying in, pampering my ass as hard as I could, and loving every second of it. Even Brad noticed I was in a way better mood every morning after I took an evening to get my pants drunk on. It was the real deal. But the deal was less real for Kristen. Her experience was not as blissful as mine. The combination of activities just didn't work for her. Drinking alone made her sad. Reading negative comments on social media while under the influence bummed her out and made her feel lonely. And no matter how hard she tried to pants drunk, she often found herself feeling more stir-crazy than recharged. Kristen is an extrovert. She gets energy from being around other people. Socializing doesn't suck her dry the way it does me and most other introverts. She recharges by having a group of friends over or by wandering off to the farmer's market. And that's just as valid as chilling with a glass of wine in an old, oversized t-shirt. Because recharging and taking time to replenish your energy is what is good for you, no matter how you do it. What I really loved about living by Pants Drunk was the permission it gave me to actually indulge in how I naturally tend to unwind, instead of feeling guilty for watching garbage TV or staying in to have a fancy snack instead of going out on a Friday night. We all deserve this kind of permission to treat ourselves to time that is free from obligations and expectations. And no matter how you do it, taking care of yourself isn't a waste of time. So when you need to recharge, own it any way that feels right for you. Grab that wine and an old movie and cuddle up with your dog on the couch. Host a karaoke party with all your friends and sing until the sun comes up. Or grab your favorite alone time toy and go to town on yourself. You deserve it. Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I find that when a lot of people say they want to recharge, what they really mean is that they want to go to a spa or salon or do some online shopping or put on expensive face masks while drinking rosé. In today's world, and especially in the self-help world, isn't recharge just a code word for consumerist self-indulgence? LS. Dear LS, your findings are definitely real. It's frustrating that general concepts like wellness and recharging have been co-opted by social media influencers and consumerism. Selling recharging crystals or shilling face masks in the name of happiness is hollow and takes advantage of people truly searching for more in their lives. But I like to try to believe that all advice, at its root, is sincere. To test this theory, I always try to see if I can live by a book while spending as little money as possible. I've found that recharging via Pants Drunk, Hygge, or any other means can easily happen without purchasing a thing. I found that while reading books on how to recharge didn't change me or my habits much, it did help me reframe how I already relax. I'm able to see it as necessary and good for me, something I can do with intention instead of see as a lazy vice. But lots of people aren't me. And I think advice on staying in to revitalize oneself may work better for those of us who identify as introverts. It can help take away some of the guilt we introverts usually associate with needing alone time to recharge. I know many extroverts, Kristen included, who go stir-crazy taking this advice and choose to relax in very different ways. These ways to unwind are fun concepts that can help you kick back, but they aren't hugely life-altering and definitely not worth spending tons of money on. You've got that right. Jolenta.
Go outside. I am proudly and unapologetically a city person. I hate being too far away from mass transit. I love being surrounded by other humans. The idea of living in a cabin in the woods miles from civilization is my worst nightmare. But It's not just that I love cities. I love the indoors. I love being on this side of a window screen while bugs are on that side. I abhor pooing in a hole in the ground that I was forced to dig myself. I think the inside of a movie theater is one of the most magical places on earth. Even when I was a kid, my parents would sometimes have to yell at me to go outside. Get your nose out of that book. You've watched enough TV. Stop building that bomb shelter under the basement stairs. You've already amassed enough canned goods. I blame the tail end of the Cold War for that last command. That being said, once I got outside, I usually had a glorious time. I loved riding bikes with my friends and going on picnics with them and collecting flowers and caterpillars that we would raise into monarch butterflies. I loved playing tag in backyards and climbing all the playground equipment in the summer. I loved ice skating and building snow forts and sledding in the winter. I loved knowing during those last glorious days in the 80s when grade school age kids were allowed to disappear for hours at a time that my friends and I could get up to all sorts of no good as long as we were home by the time the streetlights came on each evening. And from a young age, I loved going on walks, whether around a Minneapolis city lake with my mom or just from my house to a friend's house a few blocks away. The outdoors was full of possibilities and space to roam. Sometimes I just needed the urging to get out there. As I grew older, I was urged less and less. Tests needed to be studied for, papers needed to be written. I had to get to my after-school jobs. And once I hit adulthood, it wasn't just that I had no one reminding me to go outside. The world had changed into a place where we never had to leave our houses to see one another or entertain ourselves. There was the internet. There was Skype. There was Netflix. Even when I moved to New York, the city that ostensibly never sleeps, I found that people love to stare at their devices as much as take on the town. On top of that, the outdoors became more and more commodified and commercialized and seemingly out of reach for someone of my modest means. $100 shoes and $50 canteens were suddenly required for an amble in the woods. Bikes that cost more than my annual rent seemed mandatory for cruising around with friends. High-performance outerwear replaced old t-shirts and beat-up shorts for anyone who just wanted to go for a jog. And in the midst of all this, the one outdoor activity I'd always loved, going on walks in my city, was suddenly deemed not an outdoor activity. The outdoors industry and SUV manufacturers and energy bar makers and a large swath of self-help influencers made it clear that if you were surrounded by skyscrapers, you weren't really enjoying the outdoors. So, even though I was still spending time outside and walking every day and up to 20 miles per day on the weekends, I was doing the outdoors wrong, in the wrong clothes, and in the wrong location. But if I was doing it all wrong, why did I still enjoy it so much? Why did wandering around for hours surrounded by tall buildings as an adult give me so much of the same joy I felt exploring the outdoors in my suburban Minnesota development as a small child? There are a lot of answers one could give here. Maybe it's because, as I mentioned in the chapter about putting down our devices, it gave my mind a chance to wander without a screen. Maybe it was, as Jolenta touched on in the Try New Things chapter, that walking sometimes took me to new places and gave me new experiences. Or maybe I just got joy from moving my body. But I'm going to argue here, contrary to the views of some outdoor enthusiasts, that even on my city streets, I was getting a rejuvenating dose of nature. I was surrounded by more sky than I could get inside my apartment. I felt the wind on my face and the sun on my skin. Even with 8 million neighbors, I heard birds chirping. And for every four-lane road I walked along, there were 50 tree-lined brownstone blocks filled with squirrels, front gardens, and flowers. According to Florence Williams, my theory might actually hold weight. In her book, The Nature Fix, she says that the colors, patterns, smells, sounds, and textures of nature make us calmer, more empathetic, more positive, more creative, more focused, and healthier. What's more, she insists we can enjoy the benefits of nature even in the most urban settings, which is exactly what I did while living by her book. My husband and I walked through city parks and smelled the flowers. Each day we admired our city birds, from sparrows to starlings to pigeons. We planted two gardens, one on our balcony and another for growing herbs inside our living room window. And I, in a truly unusual move for me, began taking a few minutes away from my desk several times a week to look at the leaves on the plants in the square outside my office and enjoy the clouds rolling by. All these activities made me feel an amplified version of what I already felt on my long walks through the city. But as much as I loved having my life choices validated by Florence Williams, I also want to make something clear. I don't think my belief in the nature fix was based just on confirmation bias. To illustrate this, let's look at Jolenta's relationship to nature and her experience with the book. Jolenta grew up in Portland, Oregon, at the edge of the city with a forest and creek in her backyard. To her, nature has always meant sitting on the side of a babbling creek and watching the birds while smelling the rain beneath a canopy of ancient trees. When she goes west to visit her family, she always makes time to be by the ocean and go hiking. But when we lived by the nature fix, Jolenta didn't have the time or budget to just hop on a plane to the West Coast. She and her husband were in the midst of moving to a new apartment. They were dealing with packing and organizing and setting up a new home and all the other logistics that go into relocating. Thus, Jolenta had to force herself to experience nature in a new way. Instead of sitting by a babbling creek in the woods, she sat on her fire escape at tree level and listened to her neighbor's backyard fountain. Rather than walk through a forest, she and her husband hugged the tree outside their apartment building. And whenever she had a free moment, she tried to find the nature of New York City hidden in plain sight. And here's the thing. It all made her happier. A few minutes of fresh air made her feel calmer during her move. Hugging that tree outside her building with her husband made her feel more thankful for where she lived. And finding flowers growing out of the concrete made her pause and appreciate the world more. Of course, no book is perfect. Jolenta and I both question Williams' claim that nature can cure ADHD or PTSD or nearsightedness, and her assertion that we should all go on at least one multi-day wilderness vacation per year shows a lack of awareness about most Americans' economic realities. But that being said, Jolenta and I have found that going outside makes us feel happier and calmer, whether the outside is on a fire escape, along a Minnesota lake, or on the edge of an Oregon forest. Look around. Breathe it in. There's a huge, joyous world outside the bomb shelter, my friends. Dear Kristen and Jolenta, I just want to point out that the great outdoors doesn't make everyone happier. Some of us have allergies to nature and are susceptible to sunburns and also hate the cold and bugs and pretty much everything else in the outside world. Personally, I'm much happier sitting on my couch and watching reality TV than I am on a nature trail. I'm an indoors person. IP. Dear IP, we get it. Jolenta and I both have allergies to all sorts of outdoor things, from pollen and ragweed to the cold. Yes, being allergic to the cold is a real thing. It's called cold urticaria, and I have it. On top of that, we've both been known to get injured outside, suffering bug bites, sunburns, blisters, and scratches. There was even that one time I got dragged out by the undertow at Fire Island, which resulted in my back being torn up by seashells and a sense of panic I've carried with me ever since every time I'm near truly wild water. Yes, the outdoors can be rough, and we don't pretend that it's for everyone. In fact, when we talked to Florence Williams, author of The Nature Fix, she even said that about 5% of people really and truly are legit indoors people. But she also pointed out a couple things. One, many of us who think we're indoors people are in fact inertia people. Wherever we are, that's where we're comfortable staying. And since modern urban and suburban life mainly centers on the indoors, that's where the inertia tends to keep us, unless there's some intervention, like a parent dragging you out of your pretend bomb shelter. Two, even indoors people tend to benefit from an open window and some daylight. Even indoors people tend to like the look of a blue sky or stars or the feel of a light breeze. And even indoors people who want to watch reality shows on the couch all day like to see the occasional scene of people or animals outside. We're not trying to convince you to go outside. We're not even trying to convince you to watch more nature programming. You do what feels good to you. But to us, what feels good is a bit of the outside from time to time, even if the outside is just an open window. Kristen. Save the world. Week after week, book after book, for years now, Jolenta and I have done what our self-help authors have told us to do. We've written about our feelings and thought about our dreams and fixated on our anxieties. We've decorated our homes and labeled our personalities and recited mantras while rubbing lotion into our bodies. We've looked at our bedtime routines and eating routines and tracked just about any behavior there is to track. And at a certain point, we began to find it all a little counterproductive and narcissistic. This isn't to say that Jolenta and I are opposed to self-care. Quite the opposite. We think it's important to know ourselves, to seek help when we need it, and to celebrate all the good and unique things that make us who we are. We believe in finding ways to be kinder to and more accepting of ourselves. All these things are important. But too often, the best-selling books we live by stop there. They look inward, but not outward. They give tips on how to self-soothe, but they don't address many of the issues that cause us to need soothing in the first place. And just as bad, they imply that if we feel unhappy in a lousy situation, it's because of us, not the situation. What if we started trying to change the situations instead? What if we stopped focusing on just our hurt feelings about the world's injustices and started fixing the world's injustices? Would we feel happier? Jolenta and I dabbled in these questions when we lived by Jill Nymark and Stephen G. Post's Why Good Things Happen to Good People. And we dove in even deeper when we lived by Emma Gray's A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance and Bea Johnson's Zero Waste Home. Girl's Guide, in particular, helped us to tap into our inner activists. The book begins by encouraging readers to consider what they give a fuck about in this world, whether it be racial or environmental justice, women's and LGBTQ rights, or any number of other issues that affect us. And during this step, readers are encouraged to tie in their own stories. For example, have you had to face sexism at the doctor's office? Maybe this means you want to ensure that all women have access to better reproductive health. Have you personally faced the negative impacts of air pollution and climate change? Perhaps earth justice is what you want to fight for. Have you been profiled specifically because of your race? Maybe it's time to fight for racial equality. I decided that environmental justice and racial equality were the main things I gave a fuck about, partly because I felt these issues affecting me regularly, but mostly because it broke my heart and continues to break my heart to live in a world where racism and environmental destruction are widely accepted norms. One might presume that the book's next step is taking action, but in fact, it's listening. Listening to people whose stories are similar to ours and different. Listening to people who don't look like us and whose voices are often ignored. I particularly loved this step. It led to deeper conversations with some of my Black friends about the daily decisions they have to make in order to avoid police violence. And it also led to uncomfortable but important conversations about my own privilege. Privilege that has nothing to do with being white or wealthy. I'm neither. But that affords me advantages nonetheless. By the time we got around to taking action, Jolenta and I felt ready. I got to know which candidates running for office had records of supporting racial and environmental justice. I mentored young women of color who wanted to become journalists. I spoke up when I saw people of color being mistreated. I reported businesses that left their doors wide open in the summer to lure in customers with their AC. I went to my local community garden and asked how I could help out. I cleaned up trash on the sidewalks. I donated to one of my favorite environmental organizations. I called the governor to voice support for environmental legislation, and I used whatever platforms I had to help the world and its inhabitants. As for Jolenta, she took steps to fight for gender equality. That meant writing a piece about the PE teacher who sexually harassed her in high school. It meant talking to the heads of that school. It also meant attending women's social justice events and learning more about all the ways that misinformation, particularly about reproductive health, was hurting women. Admittedly, our efforts led to different personal outcomes. Jolenta felt a slight increase in her anxiety about the state of the world, but that anxiety was far outweighed by a sense of strength. To quote her, "I felt more empowered than ever in the face of sexism and other biases that usually seem so overwhelmingly big. I used to feel paralyzed by the idea that little old me couldn't do anything impactful enough to make real change." But Living by a Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance took the paralysis away. I've actually found that fighting for social justice alleviates my anxiety a bit. The more I volunteer or donate to environmental causes, the less I feel I don't deserve to be on the planet. The more I volunteer with diverse teens, the less fear I feel about the future world they'll grow up in. And the more I stand up for others, the more I believe it's possible that others will stand up too. To be clear, neither Jolenta nor I think we can save the whole world. We're just two people. but maybe we'll make one person's day a little better today, and another person's tomorrow, and another's the day after that. And in the midst of these tiny steps, she'll feel a little more empowered, and I'll feel a little less anxious. And isn't that so much of what self-help is about? Prepare to die. Jolenta is extremely fortunate in that very few people she's loved have died so far. But on the flip side, she's also unfortunate. She's the only child of two parents who live in different states, many time zones away, and she's well aware of the fact that when they die, it will be on her to carry out all their wishes, manage their assets, arrange their final resting places, and settle all the legal matters that need to be settled. It will be on her to feel the deep sense of loss a child feels, without a sibling to share the emotions. It will be on her to do it all, and it will be painful. And so, I suppose it's not surprising that Jolenta usually likes to avoid the topic of death, her own or anyone else's. To her, death is both a distant concept and a heavy burden. And it's for this reason that I wanted to live by a book about death for our show. I figured a lot of listeners were in the same boat as Jolenta, walking the line between emotional avoidance and legitimate fears, both knowing that death is inevitable and hoping it won't need to be considered for a long time. Sadly, in most Western cultures, we don't spend a lot of time talking about death or preparing for it. When it happens, it often hits us like an otherworldly event we never saw coming, even though, logically speaking, we all know that we'll someday die. My husband Dean and I know this from firsthand experience. We both lost parents and grandparents to whom we were quite close. And in both our cases, we've come to understand the importance of accepting and preparing for death. Dean's father's death was sudden and unexpected, and it happened on the other side of the world, on the South Island of New Zealand where he grew up. There was a lot of shock and pain to process. There was the regret over not having had the chance to say goodbye. And there was the logistical nightmare of taking 4 connecting flights across the world from the United States to be reunited with his mother, sister, and extended family. Once Dean arrived, the emotional pain was exacerbated by the pain of realizing his father had never planned for his own death. His finances were not in order. His papers, most of which were impossible to decipher, were spread far and wide across his family business and home. At one point, Dean and his mother and sister considered bringing in a forensic documentation expert to help. In the end, after many tireless hours and a lot of agony, they managed to arrange a funeral and save the business, and all of this was on top of losing someone they deeply loved. My mother's death was also a sudden and unexpected event. She had been fighting a severe cold for many months. She'd also been acting not quite like herself. She seemed needier than usual, and I wasn't sure why. But I knew I'd be there in a few weeks, at the same time I visited her in Minnesota every year. I told her to take good care of herself until my annual visit. And I put my trust in my aunts and uncles and extended family, all of whom still lived in Minnesota, to drag my mom to the doctor if things got truly bad. But then I got the call. My mother was in bad shape. She was in the hospital. I needed to get on a plane immediately. They didn't know if she would make it. I booked the first flight I could. The flight was delayed and then delayed some more. The woman sitting next to me on the plane, hearing my story, said she'd get her husband to take me to the hospital when we landed. Thanks to that woman, whose name I can't remember, I made it in time to see my mother conscious one last time and tell her I loved her. She went into a coma that night. As my sister, aunts, uncles, and I waited for the doctors to find out what was happening with my mother, I remained hopeful that there would be a clear diagnosis and an obvious course of treatment. But eventually it became clear. My mother had metastatic cancer, and it had spread everywhere, including her brain. We could keep her in the coma for as long as we wanted, or we could disconnect her from life support and let her die. No one wanted to be the one to give the order to disconnect, but I remembered what my mother had always told me. Please don't keep me artificially alive. And so I said out loud what no one else would. Please disconnect her. My sister and aunt,